I want to thank this episode's sponsor, Castellanets LLP, a leading law firm in tax controversy, white-collar criminal defense, and government negotiations, with offices in New York City and Washington, D.C. Visit www.kflaw.com.
This is the podcast for women who want to create careers and lives they love. I'm your host, Heather Pincher. Welcome to the Powerful Professional Women Podcast. If you want to create a career and life you love, then you're in the right place. I'm an attorney practicing tax law in Washington, D.C., and I started this podcast because I'm on a quest to learn everything I can from successful professional women, and I want to share that journey with you. I want you to be empowered, informed, and inspired by the women on this podcast because I want us all to win. And every woman's path to success is her own, so take what works for you and set aside the rest. I'm thrilled to have Gloria Cordez Larson on the podcast today in front of a live audience to tell her story and provide actionable insights on optimism. Gloria is a Boston business leader, respected lawyer, and public policy expert, and for over a decade, she served as the first female president of Bentley University. A recipient of numerous awards and honors for qualities like Power 50, Visionary Leader, and Change Agent, Gloria has served as a director on several public company boards and in top leadership positions with the Federal Trade Commission, the Massachusetts governor, and before joining Bentley, she co-chaired the Boston-based law firm Foley Coag's Government Strategies Group as a partner. While at Bentley, Gloria launched the Center for Women in Business, which the board has since renamed in her honor, the Gloria Cordez Larson Center for Women in Business. Gloria, thank you for joining us. I'm thrilled to have you on the podcast today.
Heather, thank you so much for allowing me to join you. I'm thrilled, and I have to tell you, I feel more passionate than ever just hearing your introduction. This is going to be fun, and boy, do I have some career-long mistakes I've made to share with others, always in the hopes that others will learn from mine and not repeat them.
I can't wait to learn from you. Let's dive right in. So, Gloria, you've had an extraordinary career. Wide range of experience. I'm super excited to hear what you have to say today. We're talking about optimism. So for anyone who meets you, we can see in a moment you are filled with optimism. And Shakespeare has been quoted as saying, your greatest strength begets your greatest weakness. How has optimism been one of your greatest strengths and also one of your greatest weaknesses?
Thank you for the double-edged question, Heather. Let me start with the positive side of optimism. As from the time I was a little girl on through law school and into my career, I've always been a 90% glass full optimist, always believing that the future holds great things. And at the same time, I've always brought a positive attitude, particularly when I got into the workforce. I thought having a positive attitude, knowing that I was already a people connector just by personality type, that positive attitude would carry me a long way. I also realized that that along the way that there was something odd about hierarchical leadership back in the old days when I graduated from law school in 1977. Things were still almost run, organizations of all types, with it's sort of a pyramid where you had a reporting group in the C-suite who basically ruled the roost. And along the way, it always struck me as odd, I think particularly as a woman. And I always thought there should be greater equity, but I also thought that the type of leadership should be about empathy. It should be about how you connect with others. You should lead with kindness. And I think empathetic leadership, one of the things I'm happiest about is that today, that really is what is taught in law school and B school. And it's really what I'm seeing most good organizations, most successful organizations lead from the top with that kind of both optimism, which many studies have shown is not only good for personally as a leader, but it's really great for organizations too, to have that type of leadership. I can tell you, thank you for quoting Shakespeare. I can tell you that from time to time, I've made mistakes, particularly early in my career. And I think for too long in my first decade, I wore rose-colored glasses. And I thought, you know what? If I just go to bed tonight, pull the pillow, the covers up and the pillow over my head, tomorrow things will be better. That's not how life works. That's not how careers work. And I had to realize that optimism doesn't mean, yes, you can have vision. Yes, you can be focused on the future. But you also have to be really clear-eyed about what's happening to you now, not just with mistakes, but with the type of organizational challenges that every company, every NGO, every government all face. You've got to be clear-eyed about what's realistic today. You've got to use data. You've got to gather the evidence. And then what's great is that optimism helps you as a mindset figure out solutions. I think it's one of my favorite leaders of the organizational world, Adam Grant, who's written many books that include things about confidence and optimism in the workplace. And one of the things he says is that if you don't see the possible, you can't solve problems. So that's where an optimistic mindset helps. But it took me quite a while to figure out that I was going to make a lot of mistakes and that I needed to learn from those and get ahead of those rather than just wishing and hoping they'd go away.
Right, right. Tell us about one of your challenges. What did you face? And then how did you overcome it, Gloria?
Well, it took quite a while. I was already in my 40s when I faced what some could consider your Alamo, because it was so public. I had worked for two prior governors, Governor Bill Weld in a cabinet post, two cabinet posts, and then later for Governor Cellucci. And when I got to my law firm, Foley Hoag, Governor Cellucci called me and said, I have a job for you. It's a nonprofit role for you. I need you to chair the Convention Center Authority for Massachusetts. We're about to give you over $800 million to build a brand new convention center over in the Seaport. I was thrilled to take the role, particularly when I said, is it going to take much work? You know, I'm a partner still relatively new in my law firm. And he said, oh, don't worry, you can do this in your sleep. Well, of course, I basically had to turn my law firm practice into a 501c3 for almost a decade because we hit every major roadblock you could ever imagine. We were trying to build the convention center in the wake of the Big Dig, which famously, as those in Greater Boston know, but was known throughout the country, was where we buried the Central Artery Highway and recreated the Greenway and beautiful open spaces. But that project was not only over budget by literally millions and millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars toward the end, but it also was plagued with lots of fraud and lots of mistrust on the part of the public. So to be building in the wake of that, you would have thought that I would enter in a clear-eyed way. But here's what I did at my very first press conference. I got to the microphone, and after, you know, the introductions, I said, I am so thrilled to chair the Convention Authority and to have this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to build this $850 million project so needed for our travel and tourism industry on the waterfront. And we are going to be the first major public project in all of New England to be built on time and on budget. Heather, what the hell was I thinking? This was a project that we hadn't even hired an architect yet. And I was just basically raising expectations through the rooftop. And I was raising them in a part of the country that often sees through a lens of a bit of cynicism, and particularly having gone through what the whole area did with the Big Dig. So the media was relentless. Every time I stepped to a microphone, they asked me, are you going to be able to stay on budget and on time? Well, within our first year, we ran into major cost overrun, potential issues. We hadn't even put steel up yet, but we ran into big issues. We had to fire our construction manager within the first 18 months. All these problems were happening, and I was getting buried. You will know that it's a terrible story in the Boston Globe when it's above the fold on the front page, old-style newsprint, and they have a bad, grainy photo of you. Leading, you might as well not even read the story. This was happening to me routinely, and I knew I had to do something. And I dug deep for my past mistakes, and I thought, real-time candor. Why are we allowing the press to feed us this castor oil on a regular basis? Every time I have a problem, why don't I go public with it? And my board was convinced that this would be a great idea. I had an unbelievable team around me with real superstars. And we decided we'll explain every glitch and we'll offer an action plan. And along the way, this is a project that we started. I think we were first in the ground in the late 90s, 98, 99. We didn't open until 2004. So you had this long timeline. Over time, it earned us a lot of credit for, first of all, being candid about our issues. Secondly, coming up with a plan, this sort of clear-eyed view of what the possibles are to fix these problems. And Also, the ability to start to gain some public acceptance. At one point, there were major members of the legislature leadership who were calling for us to stop the project because they were so worried in the wake of 9/11 that people wouldn't be returning to big scale meetings any longer, that the cost overruns would bury us, and this was just a doomed project. Well, ultimately, in 2004, because we had along the way sort of, come up with ways to deal with our issues very publicly. By the way, that was very painful personally. My law partners were saying, why don't you resign politely? Why don't you, come back to the firm? You're still operating out of your office, but we'd love to have you back actually practicing law with us. And ultimately, though, it was a great story because at the end, we were given a huge amount of credit. We did open on time and on budget. And that took just a tremendous, tremendous amount of effort. And even the media, this is called, I think, damning with Saint praise. But there's a well-known journalist in Boston, Boston Globe, named Joan Vanocki. And she's not known for writing puff pieces. And early in the process, she wrote what many people think about optimists who don't have a clear-eyed, realistic view about things at the same time. She wrote, they've named Gloria Larson, and so far, all she is a Southern cheerleader with pom-poms. And I don't think that's what we need in Boston to complete this project. And I was horrified. It was, a nightmare to face. At the end of the project, she wrote another column and she said, well, guess what? I was wrong. She is a Southern cheerleader. She does have pom-poms, but they're pom-poms of steel. So I discovered this invaluable lesson about, I call it real-time candor. I'd rather drink my own castor oil and admit something than allow others to be blamed for the mistakes and allow the press to have a concept and the public generally and legislators, those funding it, to have a general view that this was a project that was going to be a failure. So we worked hard to make in the end exactly the opposite of that.
Wow, Gloria.
But it's just a fabric without this incredible team, Heather. I mean, it's not
right.
They went along with this. I think at the time, first of all, my team, my fellow board members were horrified that I'd said we were going to be on budget. That's my first announcement out of the gate. But they worked with me because, I had a powerful developer on the board. I had all travel and tourism people. It was really wonderful. And I think there are so many takeaways here about being a realistic optimist. The mindset that carries you forward. Because think of the positions in the C-suite that so many of your listeners will hold up every type of organization. If you have this ability to say what you've done wrong and move forward because you have a mindset that there are virtually no problems that can't be resolved some way along the way, I think that carries you forward in such a powerful way. It allows you to preserve your own optimism, as well as your positive mindset. And Heather, it also allows you to gather a team around you who feel like they're equally inspired to get it done. They're equally going to believe in the potential, the possibilities to cure whatever ails a particular situation. And those are things that you can carry into any opportunity that you have. And I wish I'd learned this lesson in that powerful way earlier in my career, but goodness knows it has really held me in pretty good stead since then, because I always refer back to it. And I should say that I see this as an issue faced by companies all the time. Lawyers are telling them, you and I are both attorneys, but lawyers are often saying, keep this the information so far until we have perfect information. Don't go public with things. I've seen so many CEOs stand up at the microphone in a really bad circumstance and say, well, I can't say anything publicly now. We're still gathering the evidence. And at some point, there's a balance beam opportunity where you need to just simply be as candid as you possibly can. And then after you've been candid, after you've done your mea culpas, which I've had to do many a times, including a number when I was later president of Bentley, where I had to say, I made a big mistake here. I'm sorry. Here's what we're going to do going forward. And in some cases, you have to just own it. It wasn't always my mistake. Sometimes it's the mistakes of others. But when you reach a position of authority, you have to own it. You have to be the responsible party. So even if it was somebody else's mistake, could have been your board of trustees, could have been other people in the cabinet that you're overseeing. It doesn't matter. You own it. And I think that's something that we can all learn from, whatever our position is, whether we're a team leader, we're in the C-suite, whatever it is along the way. Even in your first 10 years in the workplace, I think it's so important to learn that you shouldn't procrastinate. You need to just go live as soon as you possibly can with what's gone wrong, particularly if you've personally made a mistake, and then figure out how best to correct it and move forward, because you will have gained the trust from others that allow you to move forward. I was afraid with the convention center that I had come so close to losing the confidence of the people paying for it in the legislature, that when the then Speaker of the House said to me, "I don't know if we should continue with this project." And I said, "But Mr. Speaker, we have steel in the air already. The line has been cleared. We have massive amounts of steel. And yes, I know steel prices are going through the roof. We've got to do something about this project. We will, I promise you." And my promise is always, not only will I keep the public informed, but before I inform the public, I'll keep you and other leaders who consider this such a consequential project for the Commonwealth, I'll keep you all well informed. You'll hear it first from me. And I think those are things, you know, that, again, optimism and a positive attitude doesn't prevent you. And in fact, I think it compels you more than you might think to be straightforward about things as when you're able to, as soon as you're able to.
And what I'm hearing you say is being optimistic, positive, without the rose-colored glasses requires a level of humility and like self-awareness, and then like willingness to be vulnerable in the correct way, to admit a mistake. But when we do that more quickly, then we can resolve it more quickly. And the way that you've handled that, back to empathetic leadership, and it sounds like your team, you inspired your team to be on board with you, that you, as a united front, would take on the current problem or resolving whatever it was.
Well, you know, I think you just summarized that really well. I would say also that for your teammates, you have to be really careful not to criticize, as the optimist and the empathetic leader, not to jump and criticize them for mistakes they have made. You don't want to do things that undermine their own confidence, their own sense of self. Of course, you want to help them learn from mistakes, but you want to help them also plan for resolutions. You want to figure out, we're a team. We're going to figure this out together. How are we going to get through this together? And I think that also inspires people. Again, that goes to a different type of leadership than the hierarchical leader who says, "I own this, but heads are going to roll down below me." And I think that difference is, I'm so grateful that we're teaching now that leadership can be kinder. It's going to still be tough, but that it's still going to compel making difficult decisions. But there's no reason that you shouldn't be bringing people along with you, even as you make those difficult decisions. In fact, bringing people along with you means you're likely to get back on track far faster than you otherwise would.
Right. Gloria, what other encouragements or insight can you share with women around being optimistic as professionals that can be key to our success?
Well, you know what's funny? I didn't tell this story at the outset, but I think I'll go back to the beginning and just share this. I developed a lot of optimism and this positive can-do attitude for two reasons. First of all, I'm an Air Force brat and I moved a lot. I went to 8 schools before I got to college, and that either compelled me to become kind of reclusive and an introvert, or really made me outgoing. My sister and I both became extroverts, even though the voice inside me made me maybe an introvert who learned how to be extroverted. But that was really important for me because I carried that chip in my brain as I entered, you know, college and law school and later, you know, adult career moves across the spectrum. It always held me in good stead. The second thing that held me in good stead was two role models I had when I was growing up, and they're fictional characters. One was Atticus Finch, was the moral compass that he held always in everything he did and wanted to make a difference in others' lives as an attorney in small town, highly racist Alabama in the 1940s and 50s. And so his moral compass, do the right thing always. But the second compelling person in my life, I'll use this person, she still guides me, was Nancy Drew. I read all of Nancy Drew's books. She was the consummate sleuth who always wanted to help other people. It was about making a difference in other people's lives every time she solved some mystery and helping others. But also, Nancy Drew was plunky as all get out. She had that can-do spirit. She was a cheerleader. But at the same time, she had that realistic. I should have read more into those books than I likely did at the time. She was always optimistic about the future. She saw the possibility in finding solutions. But at the same time, she was realistic about the conundrums she was facing at the time. So those are two of the characters who have sort of had left this this sort of sense of why am I still an optimist this many decades later? Has a lot to do with those early learnings. At the same time, optimism, positive attitude in the workplace, empathetic leadership are definitely things that you can learn. I want anyone to tell me a great leader who was a genuine pessimist, who thought that the doomsday was always about to happen, that it wasn't, you know, even those who had been in leadership positions, usually along the way, that turns out to be one of their greatest failings.
Something else that I like in what you're saying, I guess circling back to something, a meaning from your story is, and people are more forgiving in the end too. Like the woman who wrote the article before and after, and it's like you had people on board. It's like you almost were collaborative and moving forward with more than just your team. People were open, more open.
Oh, it changed everything. Even the press conferences got easier to do. First of all, I discovered I enjoyed drinking my own castor oil. It was just not that big of a deal. And that admitting there's something you can get used to saying, this is the challenge. Here's what we're going to do. As hard as this, as much as you're, you know, afraid to take the mic before you start, it got easier and easier to do. But also we started to develop a following. The Chamber of Commerce, Mayor Menino, the Governor Cellucci, of course, was a longtime fan, then later Jane Swift, and later other governors who followed. It became something that was widely supported. People saw the possibility, particularly as we cured our problems along the way. And people could see what this looming, you know, amazing structure that was rising on the waterfront, which was going to help galvanize. I mean, that's the other thing. This had so much more import to it. It was travel and tourism, one of our major industry sectors in Massachusetts and New England. At the same time, it was going to galvanize development in the seaport along the waterfront, along with the Moakley Courthouse. Those were the two big public things that were supposed to help bring that together. I almost don't recognize the Boston Seaport anymore. It has turned into, you know, this amazing, fully evolved, fully developed place. And it's really in part a credit to the investment in public infrastructure.
Right, right. Gloria, we'll wrap up this episode now. Thank you so much for sharing your story, experience, and insights with us. I also want to thank our live audience who have been with Gloria and me today for all of your support and positive energy. And I'm grateful to each one of our listeners. I hope you leave this episode inspired and empowered to be your most powerful professional self.
I want to thank this episode's sponsor, Castellanos LLP, a leading law firm in tax controversy, white-collar criminal defense, and government negotiations, with offices in New York City and Washington, D.C. Visit www.kflaw.com.